Welcome to the first Jury Break of Season 2. This season, we're exploring the quagmire of doubt and uncertainty between sexual accusation and conviction. Our star interviewee from last season was, as I'm sure you recall, Jessa Nicholson Goetz, the all-star sensitive crimes defense attorney for Madison, Wisconsin. Last season, she and her law partner Nick Gansner began their own podcast, Getting Off, a runaway hit that delves into the complexities and controversies of sensitive trials by two experts. They are leading the charge this season by giving me a dual interview, and it's a really good one. We talk about how to balance victim sensitivity with defendants' presumption of innocence, as well as their views on victim blaming, all through their unique perspectives as seasoned defense attorneys. I hope you enjoy the discussion as much as I did.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hey, Chelsea. Thanks for having us.
Indeed. Thank you so much for having us. We are big fans of yours.
Oh, thank you. That's really nice to hear. This is actually the first day that I'm able to speak actually with Nick. And so this is an exciting day for me because I'm also a big fan of your podcast and of yours, Nick. And it's great to finally connect.
Absolutely. Like, I feel the same way.
Yay. Thank you.
It's all right.
So season two is launching now for me, which is a sensitive crimes case, which is really firmly in the two of your ballpark. So I wanted to speak to you about a couple issues that I think are going to be particularly relevant this season. And the first is the issue of presumption of innocence.
We have opinions about that.
We do have thoughts and feelings about that.
I know. I actually I was really moved by a segment you did on Getting Off, and it was during one of the Brock Turner episodes when you discussed the presumption of innocence and how much that should relate to the real world and like outside of the courtroom. So that's kind of what my question goes to today. And I remember during the Roy Moore saga, which for, I guess, those who don't or aren't familiar with the Roy Moore saga, he was accused of being sexually inappropriate with teenagers, like a lot of teenagers, and he was running for Senate in Alabama. And Mitt Romney tweeted, "Innocent until proven guilty is for criminal convictions, not elections." And that got me thinking about the concept of the presumption of innocence. Should the presumption of innocence be a legal one that only applies to the courtroom, or should it be something that we all apply societally as well? Because to me, it seems like the presumption of innocence and how greatly it's enforced depends on what crime it is we're talking about. And especially the less savory the crime, meaning, you know, the more sensitive, sexual in nature the crime, the less sacred the presumption of innocence seems to us as a community, or the less palatable it seems. So I just wanted to find out your thoughts on that.
My general feeling is consistent with Mitt Romney's. I believe very strongly in the presumption of innocence in the context that Jess and I work in, which is inside a criminal courtroom. And I think there's a lot of reason, there is a lot of reason for us to fear in our cases that the presumption of innocence is sort of ignored or eroded in the context of the criminal cases we work in. I, by and large, do not have a problem with that standard not applying outside of a courtroom, because number one, it doesn't. As a matter of law, it does not apply outside of a courtroom. And so I don't have any problem with there being a lower standard, probably a significant or perhaps a significantly lower standard that we apply to other contexts, like, for example, being a senatorial candidate. Now, I do temper that somewhat because I think we would all fear, or at least have a concern, that we don't want people's lives or their aspirations or their careers or their personal relationships or their standing in the community or whatever to be able to be hijacked on the basis of a totally spurious allegation. I don't think any of us want a world to exist where people can run around just playing gotcha by having somebody lob an allegation against somebody, perhaps at a particularly inopportune moment, that unfairly or inappropriately derails someone's life or aspirations or career or what have you. So, you know, as a general proposition, I do agree with Mitt Romney. I don't think it's quite that simple. I don't think as a general matter, it's inappropriate for people who might be defending a person against whom an allegation has been made outside of a courtroom to say, all right, hold up, let's actually look at what the allegation is and let's see if this allegation has any credibility to it. I think that's fair and appropriate. For the reasons that I just said, we don't want someone to be able to just run around and hurl sort of spurious allegations around left and right. But in this instance, I did not have a problem with those allegations being held pretty seriously against Roy Moore. I mean, I read them. I read the news coverage of that. There seemed to be, you know, enough meat on those bones to say, all right, this is cause for some pretty significant concern. And look, you have a constitutional right to not be convicted unless a prosecutor is able to prove you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. You don't have a right to a Senate seat. And I think that's relevant as well.
Yeah.
So I agree with a lot of that. I have a little.
We do have a different take on it.
I have a little bit of a different view. And let me start by saying, in my view, I recall when Mitt Romney tweeted that out, I think I actually retweeted it. Part of the reason that I was completely comfortable with that statement was that some of these weren't allegations anymore with Roy Moore. I mean, he made a statement that admitted to having sex with underage girls and that attempted to rationalize or excuse that behavior by saying, but I had parental permission.
Yeah, I remember that.
I asked
their mothers.
Boy, howdy. Okay.
So, look, does having sex with children reflect negatively on someone's character? I sure hope it does. I'm totally comfortable saying, gosh, I don't think I want someone who has sex with children making decisions about my country. I think that that's a totally appropriate feeling to have. And I think it's particularly easy to have that feeling when those allegations, at least in part, are no longer in dispute. And my view was they weren't. I mean, some of them were.
Some of them were, but some of them were not.
I totally agree with Nick. He's correctly reciting the law that this is a presumption that attaches in a courtroom. However, I will say this. I feel a personal, philosophical, and moral obligation based on who I am as a lawyer and a person to attempt to apply that same burden when I look at anything that I'm being asked to determine the truth or falsity of. I think that we have a better and more nuanced dialogue as a society when we are skeptical of blanket claims. I think that more information is always probably better than less information. And I think that process is important. And when I say that's a philosophical thing for me, I'll go back to everything I read in college. You know, I mean, I read John Stuart Mill and John Locke and all those guys. And a big part of the conversation about why we have government is because we wanted to trade in sort of natural law for law that was written down and had people to police and defend and ultimately make judgments about it. And so philosophically, I feel like part of what I've traded to have those protections, or what I've traded to be, I follow those rules in exchange for the hope that I get protections from it that I wouldn't otherwise have. Because if we just decided that somebody makes an allegation and so therefore the person's guilty, that looks an awful lot like anarchy. You know, when you take away process, that's what we're left with. We're left with street justice. And I do think that while it attaches only in a courtroom, and I've spoken about this in jury breaks with you before, that there are some people who have influence on our system that need to be cognizant and aware of that. And one such group of people is the press. And so when I see reporting that drops the word alleged or draws conclusions about someone's guilt prior to a trial happening, I do bump up pretty hard on that, because not because I have any delusion that the presumption of innocence applies in everyday conversation, but because I believe journalists are also fundamentally seekers of truth, and they should morally not want to do anything to taint the truth-seeking process. And so when I see things that are written in a very slanted way, I feel like it's a taint upon the truth-seeking process. And that's what frustrates me. I think it's very dangerous to accept allegations as true without investigation or process. And that's true for me, regardless of what the nature of the allegation is. And, you know, we are very comfortable throwing that idea out the window when we get to the area of sex crimes. because for whatever reason, everyone has decided that those are different. And I just, I hold a minority viewpoint there. I don't believe they are different. I can't think of a time where I would choose no process over process. And so therefore that dictates the way that I live my life.
Yeah. I mean, I do think one thing that's interesting about the nature of sex allegations is, I mean, certainly they're considered, well, they are more taboo. I don't think there's really much dispute about that. I mean, they are perhaps the most taboo form of offense that we have. So they carry with them an enormous stigma. They're also tricky because unlike some other types of crimes, including other very grave crimes, they're more ambiguous or more difficult to prove because oftentimes there isn't the kind of evidence that exists for other grievous crimes. For example, if someone gets accused of a homicide, typically there is going to be a dead body. Like we are going to be able to establish that someone in fact did die. Mm-hmm. And so we'll have questions that come after that, but we won't have much of a dispute over the fact that someone was killed. With sexual assaults, one of the things that makes wrestling with them so very difficult is that, especially in the cases of delayed disclosures, it is hard. I mean, the person who would be in the position, let's say, of a prosecutor, has to start with the very problem, did this happen at all? Did something happen at all? Was there, you know, some kind of assault at all? And oftentimes there may not be other forms of corroborative evidence that can sort of conclusively show that there was. And then it becomes even more that part alone becomes more difficult as time goes by, because there won't even have been an opportunity to have collected any evidence that may or may not have existed at the time. And so I think they're sort of they become increasingly difficult things. And that's why I think they're so challenging. That's part of the reason they're so challenging.
On the issue of delayed disclosure, in season two, the alleged victim reported the incident 4 days after the fact. And so as professional attorneys, how do you two view that degree of a delay? Is that extremely problematic? Or do you feel like that's close enough to the crime that it would make your jobs easier?
Well, so first of all, I think with a 4-day delay in report, it would still be worthwhile for her to have a sexual assault examination because semen, for example, could be collected even within that range. Number two, bruises would still be visible if we were talking about a forcible sexual assault. Number three, there's probably a couple outcry witnesses, and by that I mean friends or family members or colleagues that the person would have told first that is probably even more contemporaneous. So to me, a 4-day delay in report is pretty consistent with a contemporaneous report.
I would agree with that. And I think Jessa put that in pretty clinical, pretty legal terms. I mean, in the world we operate in, a 4-day delay, I almost wouldn't even consider a delay. And I think Jessa just said that in different words, that's essentially akin to a contemporaneous disclosure. I mean, we have cases where there might be an 8-year delay or a 20-year delay.
Well, you and I tried that case that all of it was a 20-plus year delay in report.
Right.
Wow.
Right. So, no, I think a 4-day delay is I would defer to what Justin just said. That is something akin to a contemporaneous report.
You know, is there some evidence that may have been lost because someone showered? There is. You know, the likelihood of collecting sort of corroborating DNA stuff goes down when you shower or use the bathroom or any number of things. Right. So it might not be as strong of a corroborated case, but it's close enough that a lot of the things that we see are completely absent in a 20-year delay in report would still be here. Because the other thing is, from a defendant perspective, if somebody says on Thursday, I was sexually assaulted last Sunday, that still provides the defense attorney with the opportunity to try and find out if there are alibi witnesses, because we still know the date and time that this person is saying that this happened. I think we really start to get uncomfortable when it's 7 years ago, sometime in the summer, this is what happened.
Or sometime within one particular calendar year, this happened.
Right.
And sometimes it can't be narrowed down. And I mean, narrowed down by the prosecution in a charging document. They might literally allege that a sexual assault took place somewhere within a 1 year, maybe even a 15-month span of time, 8 years ago. And that, I mean, you can't alibi yourself for an entire year. You certainly can't. I mean, it, you know, so it presents all sorts of complications. So I really think with a 4-day delay, which I really don't even think of as a delay, it probably helps the prosecution. It probably helps the defense. It is probably easier by and large to discern with some degree of reliability what may have happened 4 days after the fact than
4 years.
4 years after the fact.
Got it. All right. That makes sense. Thank you. I was just curious for your professional opinions on that. I want to switch over to the topic of victim blaming, even though it's a really, really sensitive issue. And it's something I've done a lot of reading about recently. One of the reasons is because I want to draw attention to it in season two. And I also want, I want to be very sensitive to the concept of victim blaming. And the legal definition I found this morning is victim blaming is a devaluing act where the victim of a crime, an accident, or any type of abusive maltreatment is held as wholly or partially responsible for the wrongful conduct committed against them. And to me, it seems like victim blaming is almost exclusively used in reference to sensitive crimes. At least that's how I see it most commonly used. So what are your thoughts on victim blaming as a whole? And do you, as sensitive crimes defense attorneys, ever feel like it's part of your job to do this when you're putting on a vigilant defense?
So let me start by saying this. Number one, I think that your definition is important because that last part of it, which is that makes the victim of a crime feel as though they are wholly or partly responsible for the conduct of the person perpetrating that offense. That is not the same thing as asking questions that go to trying to determine the reliability of someone's statement. And let me draw a distinction here. If there was an alleged victim of sexual assault on the witness stand, and I were to say to her, well, if you didn't want to get raped, why'd you go back to his apartment? That would be victim blaming. I think that everyone can see what would be wrong with that. Now, and I'm going to take it out of sexual assault for a second, but then I'll go back to it. If I had somebody who was the alleged victim of a mugging on the witness stand, and I asked them, it was pitch black when you were mugged, wasn't it? That's not saying that they were somehow at fault for their mugging. It's starting to point out that they wouldn't have had a lot of light to positively ID the person that they are alleging perpetrated this. And that is an important distinction for me because if, and again, this is how we treat sex crimes differently, right? When you do have delays in disclosure, and you do have a year or 6 months or, you know, 20 years, whatever the delay is, we've lost a lot of the opportunity to have that corroborating physical evidence. And so I do think that it is fair if my hypothetical mugging victim got mugged today and then called to report it a year later, I think a very natural tendency would be to ask, why didn't you call us sooner? I don't, you know, I think that that is a fair question.
Right.
Because people would expect that when you are victimized, you would take some steps to try and seek recourse.
And I think there, I agree with everything that Jessica just said. And I think as a sort of as a starting point there, we can probably think, as Jessica just pointed out, of some obvious examples of lines of inquiry or statements that would constitute victim blaming that we could all probably all agree on. And they're probably somewhere in the middle is a fine line where people might say, you know, that feels like victim blaming to me. And someone else might say, no, this is just vigorous cross-examination. But I don't think that when you get into a criminal context, when you get into a criminal courtroom, cross-examination is part of the process.
Yes.
Cross-examination is held up by all sorts of people over the course of legal history as, you know, the single greatest function in the pursuit of truth-telling that we have. And so, I mean, something that you've said to me, Jessa, before is, this is some version of a paraphrase here, but, you know, when you make significant allegations against someone, they are going to be subject to significant scrutiny.
Correct.
When the stakes are really, really high, when the consequences of an accusation are really high, those accusations are actually going to be taken dead seriously. And part of being taken seriously is that they are going to be subject to scrutiny.
Right. And, you know, there are certainly questions that defense attorneys have to ask that are probably painful for alleged victims. And I'm going to give you one such example. In our state, in Wisconsin, the definition of consent is any words or actions freely given. That's part of how we define consent. So part of that means that we have to look at behaviors not from the perspective of either the defendant or the victim, but rather just objectively, what would a reasonable person looking at this, if they were to watch it on tape, what would they say the nature of that activity was? And so, for example, I can think of a case in particular where, by the alleged victim's estimation, I mean, this was her statement, not the defendant's. She said, "I didn't want to be hooking up with him, so I faked an orgasm to get the encounter to end." Didn't say no, didn't do anything to affirmatively represent a lack of consent, did something that if you were playing the tape, everyone would see a young woman having an orgasm. And that looks like consent objectively. And no doubt, it would be a miserable experience to have to be asked questions about faking orgasms on a witness stand. But if I don't point that out, if I don't draw the jury's attention to every single thing that my client may have seen that did indicate consent, then I'm not effective. I have to ask that question. Because otherwise, the jury isn't getting a full picture of what actually happened.
Right.
And I guess you could also analogize that to an extent to something like, I want to be careful here, but let's say you had a homicide case or you had some kind of, you know, terrible physical battery case, but the defense was self-defense. Well, the person, you know, would be different in the case of a homicide. The victim wouldn't be there to speak for themselves. But let's imagine a terrible physical battery where the defense was self-defense. Well, then the actions of the alleged victim would be very carefully scrutinized. They would have to be by virtue of the affirmative defense that the defendant was offering. And I don't know if that would be equally likely to be a situation where people would feel like the defense was engaging in victim blaming, or if it would be less so because it's something other than a sexual assault. I mean, I do think that we are especially sensitive to notions of victim blaming within the context of sexual assault cases, more so than in other types of cases.
Right.
But it's the same notion of, you know, providing someone a constitutionally effective defense, regardless of what kind of case it is. We are constitutionally and ethically obligated to, you know, vigorously poke and prod and test and scrutinize the evidence against our client.
That makes sense. And I really appreciate you breaking that down so thoughtfully. And I will add this, that in listening to Getting Off, it's helped me learn a lot in regards to the difference between victim blaming and reasonable defense.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I mean, I can give you, there are so many examples I could give. It's just about judgment, really. I mean, I can think of a case that actually I got a very lovely voicemail from the victim of a horrible sexual assault. I mean, stranger rape, home invasion, sexual assault, like the stuff of nightmares. And she had worked for a while as an exotic dancer. And I knew that, and I didn't ask a single question about it because it was wholly irrelevant to the question of whether or not she'd been sexually assaulted. And for me to ask that question would have been doing so in an attempt to degrade her. That would have been completely inappropriate in my mind. And I didn't do it, and I wouldn't do it. And she actually left me a voicemail and has subsequently referred me cases, which was very cool.
Wow.
Because she was like, you know, there were things that you could have done to make me feel less than, and you didn't do.
Things that you were legally within your right to do, and you chose not to ethically.
Right, because I could have said to her, what do you do for a living? And she would have had to say. Right. But it's not, you know, I mean, the sexual assault didn't occur at the strip club, so who cares?
Right. I think, you know, something that I sometimes keep in mind, or is maybe a helpful frame of mind to use, is, you know, we're always thinking, all right, how can I present this case? Or when it gets down to presenting a particular witness, either a direct or cross, how can I ask this question in the manner that is most effective for my client? How can I ask it in the most, you know, probing way, or the way that is most likely to elicit testimony that's favorable to my client? I don't think it's necessarily inconsistent to also ask yourself, when you're a person in the position of me or Jessa, to imagine oneself as the person on the stand and say, how would a question being posed to me that's asked this way or that way, what effect would that have on me? I think you can imagine yourself as more than one person in a sort of thought experiment. And sometimes I think about that because, you know, if we present ourselves in court as someone who is coming across as engaging in gratuitous victim blaming,
the jury's going to hate us anyway.
That's going to destroy our credibility. And that's in turn, it's going to damage our clients, chances of whatever it is that we're trying to accomplish. And in turn, that damages our sort of, you know, the role that we play constitutionally. So, I mean, we're certainly not people who attempt to, or would really, you know, tolerate sort of questions of that sort of gratuitous nature. I think it would hurt us. It would hurt our clients. It would hurt our efforts to do our job correctly.
Well, and I think gratuitous is the operative word there.
Right.
You know, it is a very rare case where it would benefit the defendant to have their lawyer just completely lose their shit on cross. You know, I mean, again, just personal examples. I had a child sexual assault case that ultimately resolved short of trial. But the child victim in that case, and I'll use the word victim because there was a conviction there, the child victim had a lot of mental health problems and was having night terrors about the defense attorney turning into a monster. And so I said to the prosecutor, who's a friend of mine, why don't I meet him? Why, you know, he doesn't need to be afraid of me. I'm not going to beat this kid up. There are questions I'm going to have to ask him. Mm-hmm. But why don't you show him that I'm not going to grow horns and be 12 feet tall? And we did that. And as a result, that child slept easier and I benefited my client, because I'll tell you what is not a good scene is having a child freeze on a witness stand, because that just conveys to the jury that this is so traumatic that, you know, something must have happened.
Right.
So I think any good defense attorney has more than one tool in their toolbox.
Right.
But on the flip side of that, I would say this. To me, there is also a fundamental difference between victim blaming and asking questions to discern the truth of something.
Right. Victim blaming and asking difficult questions are not the same thing.
Right.
And anytime you are in a jury trial on some kind of sexual assault in particular, that is an inherently very difficult situation to be in. It is difficult, certainly difficult for the alleged victim. It's obviously difficult for the defendant. They've got an enormous amount on the line. It's difficult for the jurors to have to listen to days worth of testimony about really challenging topics. It's difficult for the advocates to put on evidence that is sometimes, you know, really brutal in nature. But that's the system. We are talking about, this is a system where we're trying to adjudicate terrible things that may or may not have happened. And so hard questions go with the territory. But it comes down to judgment. I mean, you have to ask the questions that are probative and that are relevant. You do not have to just try to beat people up.
Right. I agree.
Thank you for breaking that down. I think that was really, really helpful. And I think that's a really important frame of mind for any listener of Deliberations to go into season two with. So I appreciate your insight on that. Before we sign off, I would love for you guys to talk a little bit about Getting Off and plug it and tell people how to find you, because I strongly recommend anyone who's listening to Deliberations listen to Getting Off, because it is the most thoughtful and thorough breakdown of sensitive crimes, legal topics I can imagine. And it's also really, and I don't mean this to sound messed up, but it's really entertaining to listen to as well. You guys are dynamic and you have really interesting dialogues. And I think that it's a good way to digest really difficult subject matter in a way that's not uncomfortable. So I can't recommend it enough. How do people find you?
Well, you can find us wherever it is that you get your podcasts from, whether that's Apple or wherever else, at Getting Off Podcast. It might be under Getting Off with Jess and Nick.
Yeah, it's just the official title is Getting Off.
And you can reach us at gettingoffpod@gmail.com. You can join our Facebook group at Getting Off Pod. We have an Instagram account of the same name, Twitter as well. So we absolutely encourage people to download episodes and listen to us. And we love getting feedback from people. We've gotten some really, really thoughtful emails with excellent questions that have led us to have good ideas for the shows. There is, on a daily basis, there's just a great conversation going on, in particular on the Facebook group page. And we've got, I mean, it's so refreshing and really amazing to, you know, have people who listen to the podcast reach out to us and you know, start really good dialogues.
And so I will say this, we tend to talk about, we've done several sexual assault cases. We've also done several homicide cases. So we stick in the area of sort of conflict crimes. I'm sure that in the future, we'll probably do some violence that is short of homicide. Well, actually, we did Bernie Getz, and that was attempt homicide. But so what we try and do is add a little bit of levity to pretty serious policy conversations. So we make a lot of dark humor jokes. And we either do episodes that talk about a policy issue that is important to us, that sort of frames the case we're going to do, or we do sort of deep dives into cases and talk not just about the allegations or the crime that occurred, but also all of the pretrial work that is done by both sides. We try and read as much firsthand source material as we can from trial transcripts and pleadings and police reports. And then we talk about the trial, the verdict, and the larger implications of a verdict and a sentencing, if there is one, in the community in which these crimes have taken place.
Okay.
So that's what we are.
And there is, I would say there is a lot of dark humor in our show and
some graphic content because I have the mouth of a sailor.
And
I
mean,
I'll
say about the dark humor is, I think it's pretty common for people who work in sort of difficult areas like this to develop various coping mechanisms. I think dark humor is one form of that. I do. And I appreciate something you said earlier, Chelsea. We do try to treat sensitive subjects with the measure of sensitivity that they're owed. We also do employ a lot of dark humor, and that's helps us get through our day.
Yeah.
I think dark humor is important, not just like for you to have evolved as professionals, but I think it's important for listening audiences too, because I think that, you know, it's really hard to inform ourselves about really, really difficult subject matter. If I'm going to sit down and watch a documentary that I know is just going to depress me and make me cry, and like it's going to be like physically uncomfortable for me to get through that documentary, I'm going to be less likely to watch it than I am if there's an alternative in which I can somewhat laugh, I can somewhat feel relaxed while I'm accepting it. And so I think that that's a really important aspect of entertainment, is that, you know, people are able to creatively offer ways to impart uncomfortable information in a way that's comfortable to receive. And so I really appreciate that aspect of your show, and I think your audiences would agree.
I appreciate that.
Thank you very much.
So on that note, I'll be signing off, but I really hope to interview you guys again during this season, if that's okay with you.
Oh, we're excited to talk about it. And I've had a little bit of insight into this just because Chelsea and I went back and forth via email on some legal points. And so I am particularly excited because I kind of know the tip of the iceberg of what's coming, and it's going to be so good. Like, I know it's going
to
be great.
AKA me picking her brain and begging her to help me navigate difficult legal issues. Like, how do I get this into evidence? And we should do a mini episode at some point on that, on the back and forth in which you like held my hand and guided me through how to get something that was completely inadmissible into evidence.
No, you're being really modest, but what stands out to me in that, see, you felt insecure about having to have the help. The thing that was so funny to me is until you sent me the thing that we were talking about, I had no idea. And then the second I saw it, I was like, oh, you do this, this, and this. Because apparently my mind is so lawyer brain that I am unable to, I can't do it unless it's in front of me, which right. I was pretty embarrassed about. So
you needed the, you didn't need the abstract. You needed the specifics. Like, give me a document and I'll tell you how to get it in.
Right. Exactly. Right, right. Like, I'm very literal, I guess.
All right. Well, thank you so much, you guys.
Absolutely. Good thank talking you. To you, Chelsea.
Thanks to Jessa and Nick for sharing these views, and definitely check out Getting Off. Before you go, I'd like to say something about a very special person. After giving an interview to Getting Off last week about my motives for creating Deliberations, I realized I forgot to mention the single person most instrumental in shaping my views and inspiring my questions about jury structure. Her name is Nikki DeRosa, or Nikki No. Growing up, we once went to our town courthouse just because we wanted to find a real trial to watch. It was she who first asked me, "Why do you think we don't have professional juries?" And I've never forgotten it. So for that, I want to say to you, Nikki, thank you. Episode 2 in the trial of Keith Montgomery drops in 2 days. Find me on Twitter at DeliberationPod and join the talk in our Facebook group, Deliberations Room. We'll see you in 2 days.